may be seated. Even before children learn one of their first words, they are always already showing that they know the attitude of it. That word, of course, is mine. Even before they learn that word, they're trying to hang on to what they have, or to take something from another child, perhaps. There's that attitude. It's mine. I want it. Let me have it. That attitude doesn't really leave us as we grow up, does it? We grow up and become teenagers, perhaps, and we say, well, I have to be like my peers. I have to wear the same fashions that they have. I want to look like them. I don't want to stick out. These are the things that I want. And then we move on into adulthood. And it's our desire to keep up with the Joneses. And that happens in a community level too, doesn't it? We set up rules for what we want our neighborhood to look like, and anyone that doesn't conform to that isn't allowed to move into our neighborhood. Or if they are in the neighborhood and they don't keep their place the way we want it to be kept, then we fine them and perhaps put pressure on them to get them out. And it goes on to the larger picture as well. Began to think just this morning, if covetousness were removed from our society, how much lower would the national budget be? My first thought was, it wouldn't be half as much as it is. And then I began to think, well, probably 90% or more of our national debt would be gone, or national budget would be reduced. After all, we have our reasons for wanting this or that or the other thing. Think of the stimulus package. Why have we had the stimulus package? Well, one of the reasons is that people wanted to own homes that they couldn't afford. One reason is that politicians wanted to have the kinds of, to keep their constituency, and so they passed laws that would encourage people to be covetous. One of the names that many people have used for the stimulus package is the Porculus Bill. Because of all the pork that is there. I want this for my district. I want to make sure that I get reelected. I want my district to have the best. And then it moves on to a national, an international stage. Why is it that we have wars? Look with me at James chapter 4. We're looking today at this commandment that is given to us, the last of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not covet. You shall not covet. Let me just read that, first of all, from Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, while you're looking up James chapter 4. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And so it is that James, writing in the New Testament, says in James chapter 4, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you think Scripture says without reason that the Spirit He caused to live in us envies intensely, but He gives more grace? He gives us more grace. This is why the Scripture says God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Come near to God and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Grieve, mourn, and wail. Change your laughter to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up. We'll end our reading at that point and ask that God would add His blessing to the reading of this portion of His Word. As we think of covetousness in our society, in our own hearts, in the hearts of our children, in the hearts of our community, in the hearts of our nation, what's the answer? Well, I'll warn you, it is not politically correct. But the answer is to have a passion for God. A passion for God that replaces this covetousness. A passion for God, a desire for Him, to see Him exalted, to see Him honored, and to see us in our whole lives honoring and exalting Him. Rather than just seeking everything for ourselves and for our own pleasures. James points out that covetousness, and this is the first thing we want to note, that covetousness will bring you into conflicts. Covetousness brings you into conflicts. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. James is very, very blunt, isn't he? Very blunt in pointing out that covetousness is really the source of all of our conflicts. Whether it's wars between nations or battles between infants, it's covetousness. Obviously, then, the first responsibility that we have is to be satisfied with what we have, knowing that God is the one who has provided for us everything that we need according to His rich mercy and grace. The Apostle Paul was one who was able to say, I have learned in whatever state I am, whether in poverty or in plenty, therewith to be content, to be satisfied, knowing that God has given me what I need. But you see, it's when that dissatisfaction creeps in, and that creeps in because of our sinfulness. When it creeps in, that's when conflicts start. Have you learned to be satisfied with what God has provided for you? I was asked one time about whether a man would be able to provide well for a man was asking concerning his daughter, and he said, well, here's a man that wants to marry my daughter. Do you think he'd be able to care to provide for my daughter? My answer, of course, was, well, that depends on what kind of lifestyle they want to live. That's not the concern you need to have, Dad. There's a different concern that's given to you in the Scriptures. The concern that Jesus gives to us in the Scriptures is, does He love God? And does he love my daughter? Those are the only concerns. Because God will provide for them. If they decide that they have to live high on the hog, then that's their problem. But if they will be satisfied to live in a tin hut someplace, they will be satisfied with God. As Paul says, I have learned whatever state I'm in therewith to be content. So be satisfied with what you have, but also recognize then that others will seek what you have. The more you have, the more you have to do to protect what you have. Have you thought about it that way? Here are all the things that I want. Boy, if I get them, now how do I protect them? What do I do to guard them, to make sure nobody takes them from me? Jesus tells the parable, of course, about the strong man who guards his possessions until someone stronger comes by and takes them from him. We have read from Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus says, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And so in writing to the young pastor, the Apostle Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Much is required to protect wealth, and so your attention would be diverted toward preserving what you have, if that's where you set your heart, rather than having the passion for God that destroys covetousness. And he goes on, of course, to say there, to lay up your treasure in heaven. Think about the difference. The treasure there is not just for a few decades, it's for eternity. The treasure there does not need any kind of guard for it to be protected. And the treasure there is free. What a difference between the treasure that men set their hearts on in this life and the treasure that God has prepared for us. How glorious that is. And God is pleased with you when you seek Him above all else. Have you set your heart on Him in that way so that you would have a passion for God? You can have a passion for all sorts of things. And you might just examine your own life. What is it that I really get passionate about? Is it for the Yankees to win the World Series? Is it for me to have the best fashions in life? And to make sure that I don't stick out among my peers, but that I'm able to look like them? Is it for some other thing that is fleeting? Or is it to see God exalted? To see Him honored in all of life? Covetousness will bring you into conflict. It diverts your attention. It keeps you from honoring the Lord your God. It keeps you from purpose number one. To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Well, James, after mentioning the battles that come because of covetousness, goes on to speak of prayer. Have you ever thought of your prayers as being covetous? That's exactly what James is saying here, that many times the prayers, even of God's people, are covetous. We kind of get our laundry list of things that we want. Oh, if God could only be a cosmic Santa Claus to give us exactly what we want. Isn't that what he's there for? And that's the attitude you find among a number of people. Well, why does God allow these bad things to happen to us? Why doesn't God just give us all sorts of good things? That's not his job. That's not his responsibility. Yes, he's able to do that. But you see, we need to learn from our sin. We need to learn from our evil and see how bad it is. And so God lets us go our own way and to bring us into these evil times in order that we might experience those consequences and be turned from them to learn to have a passion for Him. Prayer is not for seeking selfish ends. You remember Hezekiah, one of the good kings of Judah? He was one who was very faithful when Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, came and surrounded Jerusalem and would destroy it. And he trusted in God and pleaded to God for mercy, and God destroyed the Assyrian army. A short time later, Hezekiah became sick. And God sent the prophet to him and said, "Set your house in order, you're going to die." And Hezekiah began to pout. He turned toward the wall and said, "Lord, I've served you faithfully, and you're going to take my life now?" And so God sent the prophet back and said, "Okay, you have 15 more years." What would you think if you knew exactly how many years you had left? I remember being in China, seeing the punishment that was being given to someone who had absconded with money. And they said, "Okay, he confessed, so we're going to give him 2 more years before we execute him." We kind of felt like, is that really more of a punishment that he has to think about this for 2 years, knowing that it's going to come? Come to think of it, that was almost 2 years ago. I saw that in the paper there. Well, here's Hezekiah, who's given 15 more years. And what does he do during that time? Well, people from Babylon come and he shows them all that he has. Look at what I have. And God says, that's all going to be wiped away. What else happened in that 15 years? A son was born to him who became king after him. His name was Manasseh, the worst of the kings of Judah. And it's particularly for his sins that God notes that for his sins that Judah was sent into exile. Think of Hezekiah's prayer and how God answered that prayer and gave him another 15 years of life. How much better it would have been for him to have ended his life when God said, first, it's going to end. For him to be with God in heaven, instead of having these things happen to the nation that happened because he remained. Prayer instead is for seeking God and His glory. In our session meeting, we noted in our devotions from Acts chapter 13, how that there were teachers and prophets in Antioch, and it names them there, and says that they were, while they were fasting and praying, God said, "Set apart to me Paul and Barnabas for the work to which I have chosen them." They were people who were proactive. They were fasting and praying. They were passionate for God. They were seeking His face. And we mentioned this at the RTF board meeting, and one of the men said, well, one of the trade routes from China was one that came through Antioch overland. It may be that God, we don't know for sure, but it could very well be that God used those apostles, those prophets and teachers to take the gospel to China as people came through and would hear the gospel in Antioch. At any rate, God did prepare for them, Saul and Barnabas, so that they could go into various parts of the world in order to proclaim Christ. You see, prayer is for seeking God and His glory, not for our selfish purposes. And so it is our duty to pray for Jesus' sake, to seek His will alone, not our will, but as Jesus Himself prayed, not my will, but yours be done. Our concern in prayer is not how can I get my will accomplished, but how can God be honored? How will He be glorified? And so we are called to be those who call on Him with godly motives. As a contrast to that, James says, beware of being friendly with the world. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Notice there's no middle ground there. If you are a friend of the world, then you are a hater of God. Now that's pretty strong language. But it's biblical language. That doesn't mean you can't be a friend of anybody in the world. But if you are a friend of any of the world's passions and desires, then you are a hater of God. As you examine your life for the passions that are there, are those passions making you a hater of God? Desiring fashion or fame or anything else above God is hostility toward Him. The world's values often constrain Christians and call us to love those things. And we begin to deteriorate in our walk with Christ instead of being passionate for Him. Well, this brings us to our third point that we want to consider and final point, and that is, of course, that we are to be passionate for God. Covetousness has been called the mother of all sins. And that makes a lot of sense. Because really, all sin springs from a covetous heart. In Matthew chapter 15, Jesus basically says the same thing, only in different words. There were some who were concerned that Jesus didn't wash ceremonially before every meal. Now, children, this isn't anything that you can tell your parents about. Well, see, Jesus didn't wash before the meal, so I don't have to. No, this is a ceremonial thing. It's not a matter of cleanliness. It's a ceremonial thing in which they thought they had to be right with God by washing their hands before the meal. And Jesus says it's not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out of it. Particularly, he's thinking, of course, of speech. He says, don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and these make a man unclean. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what make a man unclean, but eating with unwashed hands does not make him unclean. Those things, of course, are covetousness, spring from covetousness. You see, it's impossible really to deal with the sins, with every sin in your life, without first dealing with the heart. Because that is where the root is of all those sins. Unless your heart is turned to the Lord Jesus Christ so that you have a passion for Him, you won't be able to get rid of any sin in your life. It's always going to be there. Have you come to Christ? Have you come to see that in Him and in Him alone there's everlasting life? Oh, if you have not yet, come to Him to see that in Him there is life. And to seek the forgiveness of sins in Him, I would plead with you to come to Him. Now, to be sure, it's only as the Spirit of God works in your heart that you're able to come. But He challenges His people, seek the Lord while He may be found. Call on Him while He is near. Take this opportunity to seek His mercy. Because He says, the one who comes to Me, I will in no wise cast out. Oh, seek Him with all your heart so that your passion would be for Him and for Him alone. And not for the things of the world. Drive out covetousness. Than as with a passion for God. Notice the contrast. It's kind of like using the poles of a magnet. How you try to put the two ends together and they just won't work. It just drives the other one away. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil. He will flee from you. Come near to God. He will come near to you. Drawing near to God is devil repellent. Drawing near to the devil is to drive yourself from God. Submit yourselves to God. Is God your great reward? Remember, that's what God said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15, I am your great reward. And Abraham had to understand that lesson before he could really get the covenant son through whom the promise would be brought. But once he got that lesson, that God is my great reward, then he was able to say, okay, no matter what God commands of me, even sacrificing this son of the promise, I still have God, and he's able to raise him from the dead, this son of the promise. I don't know how it's going to happen, but God is my great reward. There was that kind of passion that he had for God. And he is to be your only passion. He is only your reward through faith in Jesus Christ. And when we mention faith in Jesus Christ, we're not just saying, okay, I believe that Jesus was a person who lived long ago. Yes, that he was the Son of God, that he is truly God, that he died on the cross for sins. But this is an active faith. Even as Abraham's faith was an active faith that drove him to Mount Moriah, ready to plunge the knife into his son. It was that active, that much of a submission to God. That's what faith is, not just believing certain things intellectually, but rather understanding that Christ demands my whole life. And my activities are bound up in Him. Make holiness then your objection, your objective. To desire God above all else. Many of the Psalms refer to the desire for God. For example, in Psalm 27, verse 4, One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life and gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek Him in His temple. Is that the primary thing that you desire? Or consider Psalm 42. Psalm 42 and verse 2. My soul thirsts for God, the living God. When can I go and meet God? Are you longing for the very hour that we are in right now? Were you bothered that you had to have an extra hour before you could be here this week? Were you longing for God? What about Psalm 73? A psalm that we often reserve for funerals, but is very appropriate for us always. Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. Or Psalm 84 that we sang at the beginning of the service. Psalm 84, verse 2. My soul yearns, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. And this just touches a few of the comments, a few of the longings of God's people. In order to know God. You see, He demands holiness of you. He says, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. But He also gives it to you in Jesus Christ. And that's the only way you can have it. This cycle of covetousness grips us and holds us from the cradle to the grave unless it is broken by Christ. Break this cycle of covetousness in your own life by a passion for God. Oh, how pleasing it is to have that passion and to find His goodness, to enjoy His goodness. Refocus your eyes upon Christ with contentment. The contentment that Paul spoke about in writing to the church in Philippi when he said, I've learned whatever state I am in, therewith to be content, whether in poverty or in plenty. You see, everything else pales in significance before God. And when you set your hope on Him, you come to realize that you have something greater there than anybody else can have. In Psalm 4, it's, you have given my heart greater joy by far than when their grain and new wine abound. Those pleasant things that the wicked enjoy. But what you give to me is far greater. They may enjoy their parties. But I will be with God forever. Yet evermore I am with thee. Let's sing that from Psalm 73. Psalm 73, see, yet evermore I am with thee. Thou holdest me by my right hand, and thou my guide shalt be. Thy counsel shall my way command, and afterward in glory bright shalt thou receive me to thy sight. And then that statement that we read just a few moments ago, whom have I in heaven but thee? None else on earth I long to know. May that be the longing of our hearts, that we break the cycle of covetousness with a passion for God.